Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is June 28th, 2004. Today's session number is MED 2004-01. Today's speaker is David Mezenbring. The lesson for today is Broadening Community to Better Discern the Summons. Do people of the sea belong on land? Let's listen in.
And begin by introducing myself. I'm David Mezenbring. I work at Seafarer's House in Port Everglades, which is one of the world's largest cruise ports in South Florida, Fort Lauderdale's port, and also a large container port, about the 12th largest in the United States, and soon to become bigger than that. I've been there 13 years. I started with my wife, Maria, who's also in the village this week, as sharing one full-time position, and now there are 12 full-time staff and about 20 part-time staff, and we're open from 8 in the morning till 2 a.m. every day of the year, and aspire to be open 24 hours. I want to begin first by asking, I know that a couple of you here live in seaports or near seaports, Duluth and Vancouver, Washington. Anybody else live in or near a seaport? Which one?
I grew up in Bremerton, Washington, a naval seaport.
Right. And you still live there or nearby?
No, I live in Yakima, Washington now. Right. I went from the seaport to the desert.
All right. But still dependent on seaports. The figure generally used is that 95% of the world's international trade travels by sea. At a human cost. Someone has to leave their family for up to a year at a time to work on board those ships. And when they sail in and out of our ports, port chaplains are the ones that, in the name of Christ, welcome them as strangers. I would be interested in hearing what struck you from the video. What surprises were there for you? Help cement them for each other by recalling them. Go ahead.
I noticed the lack of training was mentioned.
Lack of training mentioned, how was that? I missed that.
For the workers going, they get on the ship and probably don't really understand all the different.
And that's a phenomenon of changing flags. Used to be that a nation's flag carried a lot of prestige or meant something about the working conditions on board and the standards, the educational standards of the crew. Mm-hmm. But over the last 30 years or so, there's been a tremendous migration, and very few ship owners today feel obligated to fly the flag of their nation. They fly what are called flags of convenience to improve their tax position, their labor position. If you're flying the U.S. flag, you not only have to pay U.S. taxes, you also have to recruit U.S. crew. And those will be unionized and are 10 times more expensive than if you fly a flag of convenience from Panama or Liberia or Belize or Bahamas. And then you're free to recruit from the global labor pool, where people will commonly work much different working conditions in the U.S. environment. You know, you're limited to how many hours you can be on duty at a time. But if you're recruiting under a flag of convenience, then you can set your own standards, and whatever the global workplace will bear, you can do the same. And so one of the impacts of this has been on safety standards. A big issue in the maritime industry is fatigue. And that stems from how much work you do. If you have 12-hour shifts 7 days a week, which is very common in the cruise industry, you put that in a cargo environment, and you're going to have accidents because people are going to be standing watch in the middle of the night and tired and fall asleep. So flags of convenience help ship owners avoid improve their tax position, recruit from the global labor pool, and it alters the safety standards that they're subject to, which is another cost-saving and danger arising activity. So the training is tied very much to the standards of the flag that you fly. And just recently, the International Maritime Organization has prescribed new standards to try and raise the level worldwide. And they've had to do this. The international body has had to do this because the old principle of national standards being in place or being tied to the flag has basically gone away.
Does the international standard have teeth?
No. There are conventions, but no enforcement provisions.
I think one of the things I think impressed me from the film was, having known that there must be exploitation of seafarer labor, but that sort of made it much more real watching the film and all the ways that might happen.
Could have non-payment of wages,
yeah,
which is mentioned there.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll tell you a quick story that we just had. We had a ship at anchorage. So a ship owner tries to get in and out of the port as fast as possible, and the port, of course, tries to extract as much money for providing berthage as possible. So if a ship owner brings a cargo in and offloads it and isn't sure what the next cargo is going to be, they will go out and drop anchor outside the port, so the ship will be at anchorage. And we had a call from some three Ukrainians on board a ship that we've seen over the years, some kind of a regular basis. Some ships we see very regularly, every day, if they're going back and forth to the Bahamas from Port Everglades, or every 7 days if they've got a route that they go, or 14 days. Some ships we see once and never again. Particularly in our port, we import a lot of cement. And the cement ships are always on a charter, and you see them once and you never see them again. So this was a ship we had seen with some regularity over the years. Has a Haitian owner. And there was one cell phone on board the ship, which worked from anchorage. So we got a cell phone call that the three Ukrainians on board had not been paid in 6 months. And they were at the end of their contract, and they wanted to go home. And they wanted to get their money, and they wanted to be paid off and go home. It's one thing to wait for your pay week after week, month after month, when you're in the middle of your contract. But at the end of your contract, you really get nervous and worried about it. If you leave the ship, you generally forfeit any opportunity to collect those back wages. So we talked to them, I think, three times in the course of a couple of days. We were able to get a hold of the owner. The owner said, "Well, things are difficult. I need another cargo to generate the cash to pay the crew." And then all of a sudden, we stopped hearing from them, and we could see from visual drive along the beach that they were no longer there. Now, we don't know where they've gone to. And that's a real feature of maritime ministry, is that you serve an itinerant congregation. If you know where they're going, you can call ahead to the next port, if there's a chaplain there, and encourage, tell them, so-and-so is on such and such a ship, and they're really struggling with an effort to stay sober. And the chaplain can look for that person and try and provide some support and counseling. So that's not a good example to use because it might be an issue of confidentiality involved, but you may well have been invited by the seafarer to seek that sort of support from the next ship. There may be grief issues that someone's struggling with, and you work with it a little bit, and then you tell the chaplain in the next one. Or you may see the same people over and over on a rhythm and be able to establish some sort of a counseling relationship that way.
I think heard some cases where the port's standards will affect a ship. And is that usually, like sometimes ships won't be able to come into Duluth because they're maybe infested or something like that.
Right.
With a grain cargo.
I'm more likely that Coast Guard is preventing that than the local port authority.
Okay.
The U.S. Coast Guard can conduct safety inspections in conjunction with the International Labor Organization's conventions, which don't have teeth, but in a place like the United States, may well be enforced. Port chaplains who board the ships, more ships than the Coast Guard does, we've often seen working conditions that we know won't pass an inspection, and we can tip off the Coast Guard safety office that we think this is a ship in need of an inspection. And then the Coast Guard will conduct that and may arrest the vessel until certain repairs are made or conditions are brought up to speed. And the Coast Guard can also prevent a ship from coming into port. That typically happens if fines were assessed and never paid, and then the ship shows up again, whether under a new name or the old name. Typically, an owner will try and re-register the vessel, maybe even re-flag the vessel, rename it, maybe re-flag it as a way of covering their tracks. But the Coast Guard maintains a database that tries to keep track of this stuff. And we've had calls from the Coast Guard telling us that there's a ship at anchorage off the port of Miami where the crew are getting to be in a desperate situation for fresh water and food. Now, the Coast Guard doesn't want to provide those supplies because they're just playing into the hands of the owner. Coast Guard wants the owner to pay the fines that are due, so it prevents the ship from coming in docking. If it provides the water and the food, maybe even fuel, to keep the ship going while there's a standoff with the owner, that's a bad situation. But at the same time, it weakens the Coast Guard's position. At the same time, the Coast Guard has, you know, some humanitarian concern for the crew, and so they'll call us and we'll quickly try and provide water or food or whatever is needed. Yeah.
Can you give us some idea of how much those guys would have been owed for 6 months worth of work?
It'll vary a lot, but it's not, well, let's see, I would say the bottom of the level that we're used to seeing, at least in a contracted situation, is maybe $350 a month. Now, the top in a U.S. environment is quite good. The problem with the U.S. seafarers, though, the ones who are in the union, is that there are fewer jobs every day. And so if you worked year-round as a U.S. seafarer, you could make 80 grand, maybe more, if you were in an officer's position. But you won't work year-round. You'll work for 6 weeks, and then you'll be off, and then you got to wait until your number comes up at the union hall again, you know, and you get your chance again. I think, and you also have to distinguish between cruise industry and cargo and rank. And the rank issue is particularly important in the cruise industry, because a cargo ship will have 20 workers on board. A cruise ship might have 1,000, maybe 1,300 on some of the biggest cruise ships. So the rank there varies tremendously between the guy who's just cleaning bathrooms in the middle of the night to the captain. The captain will probably make six figures. I don't know for sure. But the rank and file on a cruise ship, maybe 600, 800, plus some benefits. On a cruise ship, on a cargo ship, 500 would be more common, 800. Really depends a lot on your rank.
A month.
Now, the companies, of course, will say, well, that includes room and board. And it includes room and board for the worker. But the worker is there to support a family and still has to keep a house somewhere and put food on the table for a family somewhere, and that's not provided by the company. Other issues, benefits issues to look for would be health care or your airfare back and forth. One of the greatest evils I've seen is, although it's illegal, but it happens widely, is the practice of selling letters of employment. A cruise line in particular, or a cargo ship, doesn't want to maintain recruiting offices in all the countries where they draw their crew from. So they work with a middleman who they say, I need two able-bodied seafarers to be at this ship on such and such a date in this port, or I need a cook, or I need an electrician, or a chief engineer, or a captain. And the middleman, who's going to be paid to supply that labor by the company, knows that that job is so valuable in Honduras or Philippines or Ukraine or wherever they're recruiting from, that they can literally charge. I've seen, we see $2,000 is not uncommon, $2,000. Charge people for the letter of contract. And then in some of the worst cases of abuse, they'll bring the people into Miami. Having paid all this money, people will, I saw a case of a man once who had mortgaged, he was one of 10 children to a poor El Salvadorian campesino who had a little bit of land, but wasn't making it. And so they decided to take the one son, send him off to work at sea. And he worked on a pretty low-end cruise ship in our port, day cruises. Just go out to international waters, open up the casino, come back, one day kind of routine. And this was right after an issue of a fire or something, and Coast Guard got pretty aggressive about doing inspections and checking the language fluency. Now the guy had, the family had mortgaged their farm, taken out a second mortgage on their farm in order to pay for the $2,000, to borrow the $2,000 to send the guy to sea. He, on his application, had been honest about his non-English skills, but he lands on this ship, and within a month or two of getting there, is rated by Coast Guard as not having enough in English to help in the case of a fire emergency on board, and so the company sends him home. He gets notice, they didn't even inform him in this case, it was colleagues who came to him and said, your name is on the list of people disembarking when we get to port tonight. Did you know that? He said, no. And he went, confronted his manager, and the manager said, yeah, you know, your English isn't good enough, you're going to have to go home. He threw himself overboard as the ship docked, rather than face his family, who he knew what economic circumstance they would be in as a result of his coming back home without the money, even to pay back the loan, let alone the extra. And I think one of the toughest conversations I've ever seen Maria have. He survived. He was a El Salvadorian, and a Polish man and an Indian man on the same ship. Saw what he did, jumped in afterwards, pulled him out unconscious, got him to the hospital. We worked with him, Maria worked with him in a counseling role, but one of the toughest things she ever did was to call the man's father in El Salvador and explain to him that his son had tried to commit suicide. How do you tell a father that the son had done that? You know, the man went home, and in his case, we were able to recover for him the cost of the I think it was $1,500 he had paid, not $2,000. I've seen up to $2,000. Those things happen all the time.
What is the common language for this crew on the ship? Is it the English?
And that's one of the things I want to stress, is that seafarers represent the first truly global workforce. English is the most common language, but the phenomenon of mixed nationality crews is very much on the rise, and is something that is I think something that seafarers offer us. I've got a list here of things that I want to start by getting your reactions to the film, engaging in some discussion. But I want to emphasize what seafarers offer us, and one of those points is access to a global community. There, every port chaplain can tell you stories of that are amazing about how people from these different countries learn to work together. There are some safety issues that come up there. In the case of the language, English is the most common language of the seas, but it's certainly not the only one. And it's not uncommon in a uninational environment to find crews that don't speak English. Some of the toughest for us to relate to are the Chinese. The Chinese are a very rapidly growing source of labor for the maritime industry. Sometimes the Russians are pretty low level on their English skills. I remember a ship that was arrested in our port for non-payment of bills to a variety of business partners in the community. And they grouped together and not just in the United States. They grouped together, they put up the bond, they filed a petition in federal court, and the court arrested the vessel because it reached the conclusion that there were creditors who had a case against the owner. Now, what often happens, more often than you would believe, I would say once a week in the United States and Canada, at least, a ship owner literally abandons the vessel because they owe more money now in back wages to the crew, in bills to creditors, to the ship's agent, to the port's authorities where they've docked. They owe more money than the vessel is actually worth. And so the owner, in this case, was a Greek, simply just cut off communications with a crew of Vietnamese and Russians. Now, we didn't speak any Vietnamese. The Russians had one or two people that spoke a little bit of English. Initially, we assumed that they were in good communication with the rest of their crew. We later found out that they were not, that they were not sharing the whole story with the Vietnamese crew. There's some old colonial relationship there that didn't bode well for the interests of the Vietnamese crew, and eventually we had to find a Vietnamese interpreter. We worked with that crew over several months and eventually got their money back, but it was one of the toughest situations because they had not filed their claim for back wages. Other creditors had posted the bond and gone to court, and they were in line to get the money when the ship was sold. Now, crew wages in maritime law take precedent over just about anything else. If there are a lot of creditors and crew are among them, crew come first, but only if they've filed their claim in a legal manner. So in this case, the Russians say to us when we go on board and learn about the situation and discover that a lot of money in back wages is owed to the crew, they say they were feeling pretty good that their vessel had been arrested in a U.S. court because of their conviction that this was the land of justice and that they would be taken care of here. They could have been arrested somewhere else where maybe they didn't trust that country to take care of their interests. So we had to explain to them that there's a justice system in this country, and it involves courts and lawyers, and if they didn't hire a lawyer real quick and get their case in front of the judge, there was a danger that they were not going to see a cent of their back wages. It was all going to go to the people that the court distributed the wages to after they seized and then auctioned off the vessel. Sometimes when you seize a vessel, when you arrest a vessel, the owner will settle up. But more often than not, if it gets to that case, the ship's going to be sold and the money's going to be divided among the creditors, and there's not enough to go around, or the owner wouldn't have abandoned the vessel in the first place. So the crew says, how much will that cost to hire a lawyer? He said, 33%. They said, no way. No way. They'd rather put their faith in the U.S. reputation for justice. And we had to recruit an attorney who worked entirely pro bono. And after months and months of problems and sitting on that ship day in and day out with nothing to do in the summer heat of South Florida and in a mosquito-infested vessel, nothing to do is the worst part of that description. They eventually got their money and got back home.
So none of these are represented by unions?
Not the international, not the flags of convenience ship. There are U.S. flag ships that have union crews, and the unions are very strong, and working conditions on those ships is very good, and people earn a respectable wage.
But other than the U.S., none of the maritime workers are represented?
Well, in other countries, some, but the first-tier flags are fewer and fewer every day, and the cargo industry is tremendously competitive. It operates on very thin margins, and it's just very tough to be in the global cargo economy and pay the kind of wages that societies like the United States and the European societies want. Now, it happens in places. The ferry system in Puget Sound is a U.S. flag situation, I assure you. But the cargo ships that sail in and out of the port of Seattle, the vast majority all operate on flags of convenience and pay global labor wages. Same thing in the cruise industry. Cruise industry is it would not be growing the way it is. It wouldn't be the bargain it is for a vacation if they paid U.S. or industrialized world standard wages. That's a huge service industry. You know, one crew to every two passengers, and now I often say the more you pay for your crews, the better taken care of your crew are. Probably, usually. One thing that seafarers offer us is this access to an international community that works. The Seafarers International Research Center is the only academically reputable body that does research on seafarers. It operates out of the University of Cardiff in Wales. And they have done studies on mixed nationalities of crews. And the former executive director and founder of that agency is just positively passionate on what a resource to the world community are seafarers for the way in which they witness that we can get along. I've seen Greeks and Turks working on the same ship. In the breakup of Yugoslavia, Bosnians and Serbs working together on the same ship. And people come to they get contact, they live in close quarters, they get contact with each other, and they make it work. I've also seen disasters. I've seen a very scared Egyptian Muslim man who was the lone non-Uruguayan Catholic on his vessel. So if the balance isn't there, it can be very scary for the minority, who in this case was being called an infidel and who feared for his life. And I don't know if he's still alive.
Do they hold on to their passports, or do they have to turn them over to ship's owners? And
that would vary from ship to ship. Generally, the captain keeps that passport.
So that's a control they have over.
That's a control to jump ship. Although jumping ship when you get to U.S. land often happens. And since 9/11, there's been a tremendous increase in the denial of shore leave visas. This is a combination of the growing security fears in the United States and policies, visa policies that were already, wheels that were already in motion before 9/11. Used to be that for $100 the agent could get visas for his whole crew. Now it's $100 a head. And Washington is actually saying that seafarers, there's big controversy in the maritime world right now because the policies coming out of Washington right now are just completely unworkable in the maritime industry. It's not feasible that a ship which moves from country to country and never knows more than a month or two ahead of time what countries it's going to be visited. It's not the new U.S. visa policy that requires every non-American, maybe not everyone, but from most countries, and certainly the countries that seafarers come from, to report in person to the U.S. consulate in their home country and apply for a visa. I mean, you just wouldn't do that before you went to work on a ship, and you wouldn't get the visa if you couldn't be very specific about when are you going to the United States and in whose care are you going to land, et cetera, et cetera. So our ministry has been tremendously challenged, and it's been a cost factor for us to carry ministry to the ships where crew are restricted. Imagine crossing the Atlantic, 15, 18 days, and you get to a U.S. port, and you just want to get off of the ship. Seafarers live where they work. And then you're denied, because of the U.S. visa policies, you can't get off the ship. Or in the case of Indonesians now, which is the world's largest Muslim population, working on cruise ships, the rule is that every time they return to the United States from a foreign port of call, which in the case of one cruise ship in our port is every night, they go back and forth to the Bahamas. They leave at 8 in the morning for the Bahamas, they're back at 10 o'clock at night, and the crew want to get off the ship. And in order to do so, they have to report to immigration. And every night, immigration checks their identity. What's your address? What are the names of your brothers? Where have you been? It's just utterly ridiculous. And you talk to the local immigration people about it, and they agree, but they are not in the mood. I mean, bureaucrats in the security apparatus of our country today are just not very willing to send the message back up the chain to Washington that your new restrictions have some ramifications that you didn't really anticipate. Seafarers are invisible to the communities that they serve, and they are a unique population. And I can assure you that people who make rules in Washington about all foreigners who come to the United States, by and large, are not very tuned into who seafarers are or what their needs are or what kind of people they are. And the concern by the Port Chaplain community is that we're turning a large group of people who could be our allies into enemies by assuming that they are, rather than recruiting their help.
So a few of them get off the ship now. Everything.
Maybe there was far fewer. We still have huge numbers coming off the ships and into our centers. And the rationale of why some get off and some don't, we'd have to go into more detail. It has to do with how often your ship comes to port. What kind of a ship are you working on? In our port, the largest number of seafarers are on cruise ships. And they would know before they left the Philippines that they're going to be based on a cruise ship that's going to be operating out of the United States, and they'd get that U.S. visa, so they'd be able to come ashore. Now, if they're from a country of special interest, like Indonesia, and Holland America Line, based in Seattle, employs about half of their crew are from Indonesia, then you have this problem that every time you come back to the United States, you're coming from a foreign port of call, so you have to report. Maybe they've got 2 hours, or maybe they've got 4 hours of shore time. That's it. Once a week in the United States. And they have to now spend half of that time reporting to immigration to go through this bureaucratic procedure before they're free to go. And what would they do based on, let's review the video. What do you think a seafarer wants to do when they touch land? Call home is number one. We at Seafarers House have placed up to 30,000 phone calls a month to over 100 countries. That's an extreme. We are considered by a couple of European agencies to be the busiest such ministry in the world now. Partly because of the cruise port and partly because of we're a newer ministry. We're 10, 15 years old. Our sister agency in New York is 165 years old. Philadelphia is 150 years old. Los Angeles is 125 years old. Maritime ministry has just been very late in coming to Florida. But being a little younger has also made us a little more innovative. And that's one reason, I think, why we're busier, more frequently visited center. But I'm not really talking about seafarers, so much as the generic maritime ministry. Phone calls, what else?
Just recreation of some kind.
Some recreation if you can afford it from a time point of view, and that'll depend on your station and how long your ship is in port. A cement ship takes 2 or 3 days to unload. I'll never forget the Filipino man who confused me one night. He was working on a cement ship. They had just arrived, and he was praising me for the Seafarer Center, this is such a good one. He said, this is the best one we've ever seen. He said, we're praying for rain, Father. Filipinos are Catholic, so he called me a father. I said, praying for rain? Why are you praying for rain? Usually people come to Florida, they hope it doesn't rain, you know. And he had a twinkle in his eye, and then finally he helped me realize that he was on a cement ship, and that in rain, they can't offload the cement powder because they got a big problem. So we're praying for rain so that our ship will be here longer so that we can enjoy your Seafarers Center more. In that case, it might be three days and they'll have more time, and the recreation factor is important. Recreation is important. Food and ethnic food is one service we provide. We have a Filipino caterer, an Indian caterer, and a Honduran caterer who set up shop on our porch and serve foods. We also sell a lot of foreign foods in our store. Some of them I don't know what they are. And noodles is probably the largest volume. So food is one.
I mean, say personal items or, you know, supplies or.
Thank you. I've had people tell me, what in the world are you doing calling yourself a ministry? And here you look like a convenience store. But actually, that store is a ministry. The shaving cream, things for the, you know, the souvenirs that they collect going around the world, perfumes for their wife, toys for their children. At the end of the contract, we sell tons of luggage out of our store. Our store will sell about $500,000, $600,000 this year in small cash transactions. They buy a suitcase and fill it up with goods in this consumer's paradise and carry the stuff back home. But maybe they don't know where to shop or have much time to shop, so a store that sells some of that is important. We could do a whole session just on what is sold in the Seafarers House store. But keep going. What else do you think they want?
Sound like from the video, beer once in a while is something they're interested in.
That's right. That's right. A place to relax on land. You live where you work on a ship, and so it means a lot that if your ship is in port overnight or you've got some hours, you just want to go somewhere. But where do you go if you're a stranger? Into the nearest bar? What if they don't like your accent? What if it's a bar of lesser repute rather than more? You know, I mean, they don't know the lay of the land. So the Seaman's Mission is a safe place.
So you actually have a bar in that?
We don't. Many of our sister agencies do. I think there's a long reason why we don't. I think we'll get there. We're very space constrained right now. But beer and wine is a common feature available in a Seafarer's Mission. You haven't mentioned the most important one.
What about showers?
If you have the recreational activity, shower is important. I wish we had a shower. I mean, they have their rooms and their showers on board the ship. I wish we had a shower for all the people every week who get off of a journey that's 36 hours long from some far corner of the world, are picked up at the Miami airport, make the agent brings them, drops them at Seafarer's House at 10 o'clock in the morning, and says, your ship will be arriving in port at 10 o'clock tonight. And the mission here, when you're ready to go to the ship, the mission will run you over. So you can spot them a mile away because they come with all this luggage and they're dead tired. And I wish we had a bed where they could sleep and a shower that they could use. But we don't.
What about sending money home?
That's the one I was waiting for. You go to sea to support your family. Who would you give your hard-earned cash to? And that's how you're paid. You're paid in cash, U.S. cash, worldwide. Who would you give your hard-earned cash to if they knew you were sailing tonight and not coming back? If we have time, I'll tell you a story. I'm not expecting a call, but I don't wear a watch because the phone has a clock on it. That's the only way I know. I find at Holden, I have more need for a watch than anywhere else I've been, curiously enough. And I forgot to bring it. We helped a Filipino man who had been saving up money for a year. $5,000 he had. And he went into downtown Miami, and a Philippine restaurant owner convinced him that he would give him a great exchange rate. And then the guy's ship stopped calling at Miami, and the restaurant owner stopped returning the phone calls. Wouldn't take phone calls from the crew member, who could only, in any event, call when he was in port somewhere. And he just broke down in tears in our chapel talking to Maria as he told the story that it had been 6 months and his wife had never gotten the money. Ooh. All kinds of issues get set up. There are wives who say they didn't get the money because they want more to be sent and they think the husband is capable of sending more. The trust factors that go into the counseling is a huge service they need. The money remittance, we moved $6 million in cash last year and didn't lose a dime. Money remittance is a big one. I'm going to just run through, because it's some of the ways in which I think seafarers are a gift to us. I'll say more tomorrow night in Vespers that I, the older I get, the more concerned I am that when we paint pathetic pictures of victims, all we do is appeal to charity, which will never solve problems. And that increasingly what we have to do is paint attractive visions of what the people we're called to serve offer us. Because basically we respond out of self-interest, even Christians, I'm sorry to say. So what do they offer us? A broader ecumenical challenge. These people come from the whole world. They aren't just Lutherans. And to operate a Lutheran maritime ministry is nuts. The more newly organized maritime ministries in the world now are organized on an ecumenical basis. I'm proud to say, although it's been a little controversial among some sectors, that Seafarers House is the first maritime ministry in the world that included Muslim and Jewish clergy on its board of directors. The Muslim was obvious because we served huge numbers of Muslim people. The Jewish rabbi was a harder sell. He said, "How many Jews are you serving?" And I had to say, "Not too many." But I said, "How did you get to this appointment today? You drove a car that burns gasoline and every drop of it came in through our port at a human cost, and the seafarers didn't ask when they sold that gasoline, what your faith was, all right?" So seafarers served the whole of, in my community, a religiously plural community. Broward County has the fastest growing Jewish population in the world. So if Jews are served by seafarers, it's a good opportunity for Jews and Christians and Muslims alike to cooperate together in providing for the needs of people who commonly serve us. They offer us an ecumenical challenge, and there isn't enough of that going around. That's an opportunity. They offer us an opportunity to improve their economy. Now, if there are any business people in the world, you'll know why I see that as an opportunity. Seafarers House grew to become the largest and busiest maritime ministry in the world. Busiest. There are several agencies that have a much larger budget. But we grew to become relatively large, because we weren't afraid to involve ourselves with the economy of the people that we wanted to serve. Sell them their phone numbers. Improve their economy, but do it in a business smart manner that also gave us the opportunity to grow much faster than we would have if we were dependent on local churches for our staffing. When we got to the port, Marie and I shared one position. I looked around, it was the early 90s. The mainline Protestant churches were cutting back on their wages, on their outreach funds, and if we had waited for church money to grow our ministry, it would have never happened. So we set up a fee for client services, and we grew like crazy. That's an opportunity they give us. They are paid. They have need to spend money. We can give it to them cheaper, and it can fuel our economy. They offer us a broader worldview. I wish I had the time to tell some of the stories of the impact that these people have made on me. That has changed the way I read the newspapers. They're a truly global workforce. We talked about that. They offer us the opportunity to empower the ministry of others. One of the reasons Seafarers House has grown so much is that when I got there, I said to Maria, if we do this ministry, we're going to burn out real quick and serve almost a tiny fraction of the need. So let's make our ministry building the foundation. Actually, it's more my case than Maria's. Maria's in direct service as a chaplain and a counselor. My ministry is to administer a foundation on which a lot of people live out their ministry. And that's a gift that the seafarers give us. From Latin American women who join our staff, you know, as their new entrants to the United States, and this is their first job in the United States. The seafarer offers us an opportunity to say to them, "You're a minister now." "Oh no, only the priest is the minister." That's a gift that seafarers give us. They give us a constructive way to do something about the problem of world poverty without contributing to a handout. When you support a seafarer's mission, you are helping, well, I shouldn't say in every case, there's a lot of different kinds of seafarer's missions. We get on board sometimes and the crew kind of cower, you know, and you know very well in the last port, they had some Bible-thumping guy who was tricking them. I've seen seminars at Port Chaplains Conference where people self-righteously share tricks about how to get seafarers into your chapel. where you can give them the word of God, you know. And there are some of them are like that. But in our case, I'll tell you that you are helping people who are working hard to improve their own economic station in life at great personal cost, that cost being the separation from their loved ones. And we ameliorate that cost. And in so doing, you're helping people who are working their way out of poverty. That's a gift they give us in this world where so much charity supports Western aid agencies and so little ends up really empowering local people. I'm almost through this list. Insight into the Cruz Institute, we'll skip that one. Volunteer opportunities, that's important. I'm going to call your attention to the two books in the bookstore that I'll be talking about more later in the week at some of my other sessions. The Poisonwood Bible, which will particularly be featured in a session I do tomorrow, and Steve Biko's writings, which I'll talk about on Saturday morning. So get those out of the bookstore. On the chair at the back, and let me not lose any more time to offer you the chance to sign up for the newsletter at Sea Prairie's House. Our literature is back here, including this newsletter, which comes out 4 times a year, and always in the best part is the Chaplain's Corner, which Maria writes, where she just tries to put a face on who Sea Prairie's House. You're probably not so interested in the black tie dinner that we used to raise money, but it's worth getting just for the Chaplain's Corner, which is also available electronically to editors of newsletters of churches. And that's another way of making more visible these invisible people who serve us, some of our other literature. And then I'll close by reading an email that came in February. It's entitled Shock Increase in Piracy. My 8-year-old boy regularly gets in trouble at school for telling people that pirates are real, you know. And people laugh at him and say, no, they're not. Listen to this. It comes from the International Chamber of Commerce's International Maritime Bureau. The 2003 ICCIMB, that's the Chamber of Commerce Maritime Bureau, annual piracy report on piracy and armed robbery against ships reveals the total number of worldwide reported incidents of piracy was up from 370 incidents in 2002, these are only the reported incidents, to 445 in 2003. That's an increase of 20%, isn't it? And violence against ships' crews also continued to rise. Last year, 21 seafarers were killed, and then in parentheses it says, although the correct figure is likely to be around 92 if the 71 missing seafarers and passengers are to be included. 40 were assaulted, 88 were injured. Meanwhile, the number of attacks involving firearms rose to 100, and 359 seafarers were taken hostage. And it goes on to say why this doesn't need to happen, and what can be done to prevent the alarming increase in piracy that's going on in our world today. But as doesn't happen so often in the case of seafarers, their invisibility to our community leaves them vulnerable to exploitation and leaves us unaware of the opportunities they give us, which is why I'm so glad you came out and listened to this long presentation. So.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, David.